The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, February 2nd, 2023. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Cedar, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Laura Katz Olson, author of Ethically Challenged, Private Equity Storms U.S. Healthcare. Meanwhile, Fed officials have approved the eighth interest rate hike in a year, despite signs of cooling inflation. The unspoken consensus is that there is too much labor power. Biden and McCarthy met yesterday on the debt limit, and predictably, nothing came out of it. House Republicans appear to have the votes to oust Representative Ilhan Omar from the Foreign Affairs Committee, which sucks. The College Board has caved to Ron DeSantis' pressure and altered its AP African American Studies curriculum to appease racists. Authors like James Baldwin and bell hooks have been removed. Two of my, you know, most influential, I think, people in my politics, honestly. The FBI is sniffing around George Santos' alleged GoFundMe fraud. You know, the one where he's accused of ripping off a veteran who needed surgery for his service dog? Like a Scooby-Doo villain? VP Kamala Harris spoke at Tyre Nichols' funeral yesterday, but still no word on what the administration plans to do substantively about police brutality. The FBI search of Biden's vacation home found no classified documents, and his approval rating, unshockingly, seems unaffected by the whole saga. In France, union-backed protests rage over the government's planned rise in the retirement age. And in the UK, nearly half a million teachers and civil servants walked out to protest low pay, the largest coordinated strike action in a decade. The family of Anthony Lowe, the double amputee killed by cops in California, is demanding answers. And lastly, the U.S. has reached an agreement to increase its military presence in the Philippines, yet another step in this new Cold War versus China. We're hoping to get someone on to talk about that soon, because scary developments. All this and more on today's Majority Report. It's in that Majority Report. Hello, hello. It's basically the ESVN crew today. No Matt, sadly. Matt's on vacation. He helps
the takeover.
Yeah. So it's just myself and Bradley flying solo today. And then, of course, in the fun half, we'll be joined by the illustrious Matt Binder and the equally illustrious Brandon Sutton. So that will be fun. But I remain quite concerned about this heightened rhetoric towards China and action. We've already increased our military presence in the region. We had an agreement about a year ago, I believe, with Australia to place submarines and other military machinery in near proximity to China, and now a second agreement with the Philippines, heightening tensions with China for God knows what reason, except for the fact that it enriches people. And having an adversary in this way, it's like the Cold War against Russia is still not over in terms of our relationship with them, but new frontiers, I guess. Now, let's turn to what House Republicans are cooking up here, because Republicans have had a hard time coalescing around a strategy to leverage the debt ceiling to get spending cuts for programs for the poor, for just general social spending, weakening things like Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. That's their primary objective, because they are butlers for the wealthy. And here is the Representative Jody Arrington, who is the incoming budget chair. Is that correct? Yes. Incoming budget chair. So this matters when these ideas are being floated to Fox Business. Jody Arrington is asked as to whether House Republicans will actually engage in defense spending cuts. They've been saying publicly that they will because they want to cut out all the wokeness. My reaction to that is, hey, half of it's wokeness at this point, so let's just cut it in half away.
Maybe more.
That's my grand bargain. But clearly they're not actually going to do that. They're just pretending that they will. But here's Jody Arrington being asked about it.
Republicans have talked about going back to 2022 spending levels. If you go back to 2022 spending levels, that is a decline in defense spending by $75 billion. Are you prepared to make that decline?
Oh, there's plenty of non-defense discretionary spending to cut, by the way. We've increased discretionary spending by $500 billion since 19. So, and then there's one-time spending like...
Can you pause it really quickly? That was because partly because of COVID. The reason he gives that specific date, 2019, by the way, who was the president during that time period, is because of the COVID discretionary spending that was necessary when we were in the middle of a deadly pandemic. But in the years before that, and I'll get into that in a second, discretionary spending has been on a decline because of Republican hostage taking. But keep going.
Increased discretionary spending by $500 billion since 19. So, and then there's one-time spending, like there's $100 billion in unspent COVID monies. There's, the cancellation of student debt, which is could be as high as $1 trillion. So,
pause it again. I'm so sorry. That has zero effect on the budget. The student debt cancellation plan was just a debt jubilee. And Biden has the ability to do that because it's outside of the purview of the purse strings of Congress. That's why he was able to do it via executive order, although it's being tied up in the courts. You gotta fact check these guys, and not in the cringy Washington Post way, but in a real way, in real time, because there's just so many lies on top of lies. But keep going.
$1 trillion in unspent COVID monies. There's, cancellation of student debt, which is could be as high as $1 trillion. So right now we have people not working. As you know, this is a problem for the economy. It also is a problem for financing Social Security and Medicare. And we need to put work incentives in place. That alone will create billions of dollars in savings, more tax revenue, and more support for these safety nets that our seniors are relying on. There are plenty of things outside of defense, and that's what we aim to focus on.
So love it. Defense spending definitely not going down. That's the only thing that can increase every year, and that was just another lie. The discretionary spending is a separate pot from Social Security and Medicare, which is its own self-funding pot. It's just sectioned off. You'll from time to time hear Republicans like Ron Johnson say that we should move Social Security and Medicare into discretionary spending, which would make it much more easy to cut. That is, I would say, one of the goals of far-right Republicans. But at the same time, that's going to be harder to sell. Something like work requirements for SNAP, and here for Social Security and Medicare. Social Security keeps 2/3 of seniors out of poverty, and the reason that you're getting Social Security is so you can have a retirement and not have to work. And for and Medicare, it's the same deal. Like, because we in this country have tethered healthcare to employment, Medicare provides our seniors with the ability to have some semblance of medical care outside of a work requirement. So this is essentially saying, yeah, no, when you make work incentives a part of Social Security and Medicare, that means no retirement for you. Sorry, work until you die.
With the, I also just find it interesting from a, like a political level beyond like the very like thinly veiled attempts to just basically be like, we will immiserate working people for the sake of the so-called like fiscal responsibility of the country. The dance that these guys are doing between like not feeling particularly comfortable actually coming out and saying firmly what they'd be willing to cut to accommodate these demands that like the never kevies tried to get when they voted present for for McCarthy as speaker. It's put everyone in a very bad position because not even those guys have a real design on being like,
right,
yeah, we want to cut like this much money from the military, we want to take this away from seniors or from kids or from SNAP or whatever. And then made even further complicated by the fact that Donald Trump came out and said it would be the biggest mistake that the Republicans could make to do anything to cut so-called entitlements. So it's like, it reminds me of that scene in Inglourious Basterds when they're at the table and everyone has their guns pointed at each other's crotches.
Right.
And it's just like, who's going to shoot first?
Yeah, after the whole three debacle. It's also just, it's especially gross to be talking about that. And I didn't mishear him, right? He said Social Security and Medicare. These are programs that are funded by a payroll tax, taxation on you throughout your lifetime, and other mechanisms, but taxation on you throughout your lifetime so that you have this money for when you retire. So we're going to add an extra work incentive. These programs are funded by work throughout people's lives. Obviously, we've spoken at length about what you can do to ensure that the program and the trust, the Social Security trust, does not run out of money. We don't need to get into that. But I'm a bit concerned because all of this talk about discretionary spending, it echoes 2011. And Biden has said that he's learned from that. I just don't know if that's the case. Because Biden, people forget, was directly involved in negotiations following when Republicans took control of the House in 2011, they were demanding cuts to Social Security, Medicare, so Obama could own it. And Obama decided to negotiate with them in good faith. And the only reason that those cuts did not happen was because part of what was being negotiated was Obama wanted a small increase in taxes on the rich, and the Freedom Caucus was so extreme, and they said, no. Absolutely not. No tax increases. And that's the only reason that was avoided. And then that led to like a chain reaction where they had to agree on a budget and there were cuts to discretionary spending that were leveraged, but no tax increases on the wealthy. And then in 2013, the Bush tax cuts needed to be renewed. And it was like, okay, this is an opportunity to be more balanced in our budget. We can eliminate the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy and go back to levels beforehand so the rich pay their fair share. And Biden, against the wishes of Harry Reid, he undercut him and essentially gave Mitch McConnell what he wanted in that negotiation period. And so we've been on a decline in terms of that kind of spending for years at this point. There was that slight bump in COVID, and Republicans are trying to use that as an opportunity, shock doctrine politics, to get more of what they wanted because they were unsuccessful in cutting Social Security and Medicare due to the extremism of their own caucus in 2011. This is their second bite at the apple, as it were, and it's important that we do not give them that opportunity. And Biden, hopefully, he says he's learned from it. Let's hope he has. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Laura Katz Olson. We are back, and we are joined now by Laura Katz Olson, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Lehigh University and author of Ethically Challenged: Private Equity Storms U.S. Healthcare. Laura, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I should say I went to Lafayette, so we're supposed to have a deep rivalry here.
Of course.
I know. I don't really care too much about that, but it is funny to...
It's a big issue at Lehigh and Lafayette.
It is exactly. Let's just start with the history of private equity. I know that was kind of chapter two of your book, but for our audience, I think it would be a great place to start how it kind of grew out of this era of privatization and deregulation in the 70s and 80s.
Well, it started in the 70s. But it was really very small scale. But it started to pick up in the 1980s, especially because there was a source of very, very, I shouldn't say inexpensive, but a huge source of money, junk bond, the junk bond industry. And in the early years, it was, they would just sort of take over companies. You know, they wouldn't even negotiate. They would just take over companies, and you know, they were seen as some pretty ugly raiders. One of the most important books on the issue is called "The Barbarians Are Coming," "The Barbarians Are at Your Gate." They're already here,
right?
And what they would do is they would take some big company, and in those days, these companies would be huge conglomerates with lots of different pieces to it, like cigarettes and cookies and magazines and just, you know, everything all together. And they would buy the whole conglomerate and then sell off the pieces, because the pieces were worth far more than the whole. And they would pocket, of course, all of this, and they were it turned out to be a very lucrative investment for the private equity owners. So that's how it began. They were just basically corporate raiders.
And butchers, too, right, in the sense that they were cutting up the pieces of companies and selling them off for parts.
In innumerable cases, these companies would go bankrupt.
Right. Yeah. So how did that work? I mean, I want to get into some more modern examples of it as well. But I think people who are learning about this for the first time might say, well, how is there profit in taking on companies that are in such deep financial straits and then selling it off?
Well, that is the myth that has been perpetuated, and certainly was perpetuated by Mitt Romney when he ran for president. You know, they take these starving companies and they make them prosperous, and workers and communities all benefit from this. Indeed, if you look at the playbook, the private equity playbook, they need to take a prosperous company, because for the most part, the companies are paying off the debt that the private equity is putting on them. And in order to pay off this debt, you need to have more and more revenues. And so a disastrous company could not pay off these revenues. So they mostly buy prosperous countries, companies. There's a few private equity companies that specialize in distressed companies, but those are very few.
Gotcha.
And they have a different playbook.
Sorry?
And they have a different playbook, of course.
Right. Do you mind expanding on that playbook? Because I feel like those are kind of the vampires that are most acute, I guess, in terms of the way that they exert their power on certain industries.
I actually not. I mean, you know, there are very few of them. And what they do is they buy distress companies. Most of the distress companies they buy were because the private equity firms before them have made them distressed.
Okay. Gotcha.
So they're not really the big problem in the game. The big problem in the game is the private equity companies that are buying these viable companies and stripping them as best as they can and then selling them off, mostly these days, because IPOs are really down right now, to other private equity companies. So it's like serial sales.
And in healthcare, which is what you focus on, when did private equity really start to dip its toe into the healthcare industry, which is what, like 20% of the United States economy, something like that?
It was definitely 20%. It's not only 20% of the U.S. economy, but it's a significant. Medicare and Medicaid, for example, are significant percentages of the federal and state budgets. So, you know, like Willie Sutton says, why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. And that's why private equity is going into healthcare, because that's where the money is.
Lots of money, unfortunately. I mean, on our show, we're advocates for single payer. So
let me answer your question, which I didn't.
Sure.
They did a little bit in healthcare in the 1990s and a little bit in the early 21st century. But since 2015, they've just been accelerating dramatically. And as they have more and more what they call dry powder, should I explain what that is?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Public pension funds, university endowments, and nonprofit endowments, they are the major investors in private equity. And they have invested in these private equity firms. I lost track of what I was.
You were mentioning how what dry powder is. Yeah.
So they started to get more and more dry powder, which is the money that these investors are giving them. And they have to spend it. And so this money is growing and growing, and the money is sitting there. And they finally decided that, hey, healthcare has a lot of benefits to it, including the fact that it's very profitable. So by about 2015, they started investing seriously in the healthcare sector.
And this is probably around the same time that some of these pension funds begin to move more into the stock market and into the investment sphere. Is that correct?
Well, the pension funds started moving away from the stock market to private equity.
Right. Okay. Yes. Gotcha. Okay.
And I just read this morning that there's an average of about 14% of their, and this is just an average, of their pension fund money now is in private equity. And they keep investing more and more money.
Is it because they perceive it as less risky?
It's definitely more risky.
Right, but the perception might be that it's less, but based on your research, it definitely seems more risky.
But no, it's definitely more risky, and another problem, it's illiquid. You know, the private equity fund keeps this money for, decades. But the reason they're investing more and more is because they believe, and I emphasize the believe, that they're getting high rates of return. There is growing number of studies now showing this may not be the case anymore. It's very, very hard. Private equity is very secretive. It's very hard to get any information, including the investors get very little information.
Right. Well, you were struggling to get anyone to kind of give you more information for your research as well on this side. I know you wrote a bit about how secretive they were in you trying to get in the process of your research.
Well, they make all of the businesses that they buy sign non-disclosure and non-disparagement clauses. And at the risk of losing the money that they were given. So people are very, very reluctant, obvious reasons, to talk about the problems that they experience once they've sold their small business. A lot of these small businesses in healthcare, whether it's autism or eating disorders or drug and alcohol rehab centers, a lot of the original owners really care about the issue and really care about their patients. And they don't understand that a lot of naivety among physicians, for example. They don't really understand what they're getting into, because they're told that what the private equity firm is going to do is take care of the annoying stuff. And there's lots of annoying stuff with rules and regulations and handling, patient times that they're coming and all of that. That's all going to be taken care of by the private equity firm, so as to allow the, let's say, physician or provider to practice what they want to practice. It's a big thing. They let physicians practice medicine. But the reality is they are totally controlled by the private equity firm.
Can you expand a bit on the point about how private equity is targeting places like eating disorder centers, rehabilitation clinics, autism treatment facilities, because they're a little bit there's a little bit less government oversight into some of those facilities, and they've, I think, been, and correct me if I'm wrong, targeting them for that particular reason.
Well, one of the reasons that they're targeting healthcare, obviously, is because that's where the money is. That's where the profits are. The aging population, the Affordable Care Act, which put more patients but also healthcare is fragmented. I mean, lots and lots of small agencies, mom and pop shops, that what they'll do is they'll buy what they call a platform, like a flourishing company.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will add on to that company by taking on these small mom and pop shops or agencies, buying those companies and making it larger and larger, which increases the value exponentially, but also gives them local, regional, state, and sometimes national monopolies so that they can control the costs.
Gotcha. And
can I just say one thing, which if sure. I don't get in, it won't, because this is one of the most important things. When they buy a company, the private equity firm puts in about 2% of the value. Only 2%. The pension funds and endowments put in about 38%. And the rest of that is paid for by debt. Now, the debt is paid back by the companies they bought. So whether it's the large company, which is the platform, or the add-ons that they buy, it's the companies, not the private equity firms, that pay back the debt. And I think it's important to understand that.
So if I'm not mistaken, that seems like a much shakier business model than advertised, right?
Oh, yeah.
That's a crumbling foundation. I mean, I don't want to say it's robbing Peter to pay Paul, because that's a little bit too extreme. But No, it's not.
I don't know if it's too extreme.
Okay.
I mean, they're going out and buying this company, and then telling the company they have to pay back their own debt.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's why they need a flourishing company. But I think the significant piece is that in order to pay back this debt, they have to make huge cuts to increase revenues.
Right.
And that's where it gets very, very scary in healthcare. You know, for example, they'll speed up the intensity of care. So the physician who used to treat 10 patients now has to treat 15 patients an hour. They'll cut back on materials, which, you know, of course, is a big deal in healthcare. They'll cut back on training. They'll even cut back on the number of physicians and put in less trained substitutes. They'll have these untrained people without a lot of supervision. I mean, there's all kinds of things that they do to increase revenues so that they can pay back this debt. And then they sell the company 5 years later. And now they own a company with no debt, you know, for the most part, but lots of value.
Yeah. I mean, I have a theory that this is also happening in tech right now, that a lot of these companies that are trying to get acquired, they're cutting costs very quickly so that they can sell their brand and get a big payout for the executives. And then, you know, the company is going to get acquired, and the workers, it doesn't necessarily matter. I mean, I want to return to how this affects the patients in a second, but workers in these fields in healthcare are also affected by this as well. And can you just expand on the layoff element when they're trying to make the company as profitable or as squeeze as much juice out of it as possible?
Well, yeah. I mean, they'll have fewer workers, of course, fewer high-paid workers like physicians. They'll often slash the salaries. They'll slash benefits, slash sick days. So it has a very detrimental effect on the workers in healthcare. And as a result, the patients. Because in many healthcare fields, it's the workers that are really there for the quality of care. When you start messing around with the workers in healthcare, you know, if you mess around with the workers in retail, so it's annoying. You know, you go to the store and you can't get someone to help you. But in healthcare, it can cause illness and death. So it's a pretty different issue.
Absolutely. You also speak about how this has affected dental service organizations as well, and how that's kind of how they dip their toe into this area. Do you mind talking a bit about that?
Well, they use the same playbook with dental services. They've had disastrous experience with dental services in the 1990s, but some of this is ongoing. They've had bankruptcies, they've had Medicare, Medicaid abuse, they have seriously abused young children with the dental care, but some of this is ongoing, and my favorite whipping boy is Aspen Dental, because it's still there, it's still growing, it's still very profitable, it's gone through, I forget how many, I think five changes of hands for private equity. But this is to have long ongoing abuse of patients, abuse of Medicaid, abuse of everything. And yet it's still going. And they just got sued by Massachusetts for fraud, and Massachusetts won, and yet they're going and going. And there's like, you know, people still go to Aspen Dental because they don't know.
And are they, so they're growing and as we speak?
Yes.
Wow.
And if you look at reviews of Aspen Dental, you can see, you know, one dentist wrote, I had to leave because all they do is try to talk people out of their teeth. But if you look at the reviews that I did, like on Aspen Dental among patients, it's pretty scary. And these are patients who went to second opinions. And yet, what amazes me is that they still are going on.
It is amazing. And especially when you see and you read about the way that the doctors and the workers feel after this kind of squeeze begins to happen. In your interviews with people, what were some of the through lines that you found?
I'm sorry, I didn't. What was some of the...
When you're speaking with doctors who have to work under these conditions with private equity, other workers at these facilities, what were some of the things that they had to tell you?
Well, actually, as I said, very few would talk to me. Or those who did were very cautious because of these non-disclosure forms that they had to sign. But the thing that I think most stood out to me was how surprised they were at the deterioration of care, how badly their workers were being treated, you know, workers that they had hired, and just how this beloved place that they had put together as a founder was disintegrating right before their very eyes, and many of them just leave.
Makes sense. We've covered some surprise billing stories on this show. What is the role of private equity in some of these surprise billing statements that patients are receiving? That have honestly been in the news fairly consistently over the past few years.
Huge.
Yeah.
Private equity, Envision, I forget the second one. There's two major companies owned by private equity that provides emergency physicians. And they are... one of the main causes of surprise billing. Another one is medical transportation, aircraft. You know, so when they swoop down and pick you up to take you to a hospital when you're in a car crash or something, that's private equity, a great deal of that, and have huge surprise billings. This is now, you know, we have the Surprise Billing Act now. But one of the things it doesn't cover is ground transportation, which private equity owns a good deal of. And there's still some huge problems with surprise billing. But the role of private equity, especially and including the emergency physicians, is pretty serious.
It sounds it. I mean, what happens when... a patient receives a surprise bill from private equity, what does that look like for a patient?
Well, right now, they're not really, in most places, that they're not going to get surprise bills anymore because the Surprise Bill Act has been enacted. What you're going to have is a huge controversy between the insurance company and the private equity-owned company. And the Surprise Billing Act did not really satisfy that issue. So there's just ongoing controversy between them. But the patient, in most of these areas, not ground transportation and some others, is much more protected right now.
And still, though, this problem seems to be worsening in other areas. I mean, what are, big picture, your biggest alarm bells that you'd like to sound in terms of the role of private equity in healthcare?
Well, I think the huge alarm bells are, one, that they have this growing amount of money, dry powder, that has to go somewhere, and it's going into healthcare. And the number of places that they're buying, like I just read today, huge amounts of money is going into fertility clinics and women's health care. But they're buying very rapidly, and they're taking over, not slowly anymore. It used to be slowly, but now it's pretty accelerating. A great deal of our health care, our physician offices, our gynecologists, our dermatologists, that's a big one, ophthalmologists, and that as they take over more and more of these healthcare niches, we're going to have, one, growing costs, and two, lesser quality of care. And one thing, you know, I know I'm a very strong advocate of single payer, Medicare for all of that. But you can't have a single payer system or a Medicare for all system even if you keep the same provider system, because then you'll just have a better payer system, but a worsening delivery system.
And to kind of return to what you were saying at the start of our interview, you see how this system exploits Medicare and Medicaid already.
Well, you know most, what I mean? Yeah, most, almost all, and I can't think of any exceptions, of private equity investments in healthcare have significant streams of money from Medicare and Medicaid, and some of them are totally funded by Medicare and Medicaid. For example, hospice is totally funded by Medicare for the most part. So yes, what we're doing is we're taking our taxpayer money and putting it into these private equity firms that are literally pocketing it. And if you look at the list of billionaires in this country, a significant and growing percentage are private equity, titans.
That is terrifying, but really necessary for you to get the word out. And I would highly recommend the book. It's called Ethically Challenged: Private Equity Storms U.S. Healthcare. Laura Katz Olson, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Lehigh University. Thank you so much for your time today, Laura. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your good questions, and it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. With that, we actually have some breaking news that I wanted to make sure that we highlighted. It's official. Ilhan Omar, as of like 10 minutes ago, has been ousted from the Foreign Affairs Committee on a complete partisan vote, 218 to 211. And one Republican voted present, but it didn't really matter. But no Democrats joined the Republicans, and no Republicans joined the Democrats. Here is Ilhan Omar's remarks on the floor in response to this. I think it's important that we highlight that this is a bigoted campaign. This is a party that has been built on Islamophobia, has targeted her for her being born in another country, and also her faith, the fact that she wears a headscarf. These are all indicators to the Republican base that we want this woman to go down. That's why Lauren Boebert came into Congress swinging, calling her a terrorist sympathizer. These are the same bigoted impulses that are driving this, and I'm sure that Representative Omar will speak to this in her remarks.
This debate Today, it's about who gets to be an American. What opinions do we get to have, do we have to have to be counted as Americans? This is what this debate is about, Madam Speaker. There is this idea that you are a suspect if you are an immigrant, or if you are from certain parts of the world, or a certain skin tone, or a Muslim. It is no accident that members of the Republican Party accused the first black president, Barack Obama, of being a secret Muslim. It is no accident that former President Donald Trump led a birther movement that falsely claimed he was born in Kenya. Because to them, falsely labeling the first and only president of the United States of America a Muslim and African immigrant somehow made him less American. Well, I am Muslim. I am an immigrant. And interestingly, from Africa. Is anyone surprised that I am being targeted? Is anyone surprised that I am somehow deemed unworthy to speak about American foreign policy? Or that they see me as a powerful voice that needs to be silenced? Frankly, it is expected. Because when you push power, power pushes back. Representation matters. Continuing to expand our ideas of who is American and who can partake in the American experiment is a good thing. I am an American who was sent here, an American who was sent here by her constituents to represent them in Congress, a refugee who survived the horrors of a civil war, someone who spent her childhood in a refugee camp, someone who knows what it means to have a...
I mean, this is why she is such an important voice. And the bigotry is central here, and I want that to be at the front of your minds. I mean, there is nothing in this country that runs deeper than systemic racism. But over the past few decades, the Republican Party was the party of Islamophobia. And this was widespread. In New York City, we were surveilling mosques on a regular basis, targeting Muslim people because of 9/11. And it is that continued history that informs the Republicans' posture towards her today. But also, what needs to be understood is that Ilhan Omar's ideology, which is informed by her experience as a refugee, an ideology that's critical of American empire, is just as threatening, if not more, to power players in Washington and to the very deep state that Donald Trump says that he's fighting against. But in reality, McCarthy and the rest of the Republican Party are doing their bidding. Peter Beinhart had a column in the New York Times, and this is an excerpt from it that I wanted to read to you. Last February, in a committee hearing on Latin America, Ms. Omar asked Todd Robinson, the Assistant Secretary of State for International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, about an inspector's general investigation that found that his agency had covered up its involvement in a 2012 massacre of four indigenous Hondurans. Despite working at the agency in 2012, Mr. Robinson said he didn't recall what he had told investigators. He didn't know if any of the Americans and Hondurans charged in the massacre had been convicted. He didn't know if any of the victims had received compensation. Why was Mr. Robinson so unprepared for Ms. Omar's line of inquiry? Perhaps because committee members rarely ask government officials such pointed questions about violations of human rights committed by the United States and its friends. And with that, now that the there will be one less voice doing that in the House on the Foreign Affairs Committee. She is one of the only voices in government who is clear-eyed about American empire. And like Matt has pointed out, a few times. She's been taking some strategic votes, and I think her apology for her statements that were called anti-Semitic, that I don't think were anti-Semitic, was a part of that strategy. And I think to an extent it's worked because the entire Democratic caucus has thankfully backed her up here. A far cry from Debbie Wasserman Schultz and others throwing her under the bus publicly beforehand. But with that, let's hear part two of her remarks.
A refugee who survived the horrors of a civil war. Someone who spent her childhood in a refugee camp. Someone who knows what it means to have a shot at a better life here in the United States, and someone who believes in the American dream and the American possibility and the promise and the ability to participate in the democratic process. That is what this debate is about. There is an idea out there that I do not have objective decision making because of who I am, where I come from, and my perspective. But I reject that. We say there is nothing objective about policymaking. We all inject our perspective, our point of views, our lived experiences, and the voices of our constituents. That's what democracy is about. So what is the work of the Foreign Affairs Committee? It is not to co-sign the stated foreign policy of whatever administration is in power. It's about oversight. It's to critique and to advocate for a better path forward. But most importantly, it is to make the myth that American foreign policy is intrinsically moral a reality. So I will continue to speak up because representation matters. I will continue to speak up for little kids who wonder who's speaking up for them. I will continue to speak up for families around the world who are seeking justice. Whether they are displaced in refugee camps or they are hiding under their beds somewhere like I was, waiting for the bullets to stop. Because this child, survivor of war, would have wanted that. The 9-year-old me would be disappointed if I didn't talk about the victims of conflict, those that are experiencing unjust wars, atrocities, ethnic cleansing, occupation, or displacement like I did.
Yeah, I mean, that is essential. That is why she is essential. I keep repeating that. But again, go read this opinion piece in the New York Times. So many examples laid out by Peter Beinhart about why she's such an important voice. Here's another. In April, Michael McCaul, a Republican who is now the committee's chairman, declared that Americans' legacy in the Indo-Pacific is freedom and prosperity, and then warned that China's Communist Party threatens it. Ted Deutsch, a Democrat, told The Witness Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman that it was a, quote, premise that I think we all share, that, quote, human rights needs to be front and center in our foreign policy. Having applauded the Biden administration and his recent committee members for their devotion to human rights, Mr. Deutsch asked about China's representation of Xinjiang and its arms sales in the Middle East. When Ms. Omar's turn came, the self-congratulation abruptly stopped. She began by noting that America's last Cold War, the country during America's last Cold War, the country supported brutal dictators like Chile's Augusto Pinochet and Indonesia's Suharto because they shared a, quote, common enemy. Then she asked Ms. Sherman why her administration was making Prime Minister Narendra Modi of India, quote, our new Pinochet. Ms. Omar's colleagues discussed India primarily as a potential bulwark against China and Russia. Only Ms. Omar spoke about American complicity in the repression of minority groups in India. How much does the Modi administration have to criminalize the act of being Muslim in India, she asked, for us to say something?
And Matt mentioned this as well, that especially in the context of this, I would really encourage you guys, our viewers, our listeners, to go back and watch Ilhan Omar's questioning of Elliot Abrams.
Yep.
When he was one of the, I think he was either ambassador or a foreign policy State Department staffer under Trump. about his conduct in the 80s and 90s in South America. And look at that and think about how that is the reason. That testimony like that, questioning like that, that's the reason why House Republicans don't want her on that committee. Because it's not about it's not about anti-Semitism or any sort of like lack of contrition for those remarks or any sort of like inappropriateness on her behalf. It's because she stands up to military power, and like she said in her remarks, she punctures the thread and punctures the narrative of American exceptionalism and foreign policy, mm-hmm. and that our actual export is not freedom, is not democracy, it's capitalism.
And it's so rare. I mean, just to add to your point, those voices, I mean, we had like one anti-war voice in that Iraq war vote in the House, and that was Barbara Lee.
Right.
And even her perspective was limited in that time. She wasn't speaking about American empire like this. She was worried about the consequences of the AUMF, which is completely valid. But this is another level. This is a refugee who's been affected by the wars that the United States empire has created, the knock-on effects, the blowback. She is a person who embodies that, and that's why she's so threatening. And the people who are now on those committees that were taken off the committees, they tried to orchestrate a coup in the United States. Gosar had a video who's now, I think, is he on Foreign Affairs now, Gosar?
I'll double check, but he definitely got some plum committee assignments as a result of those concessions that McCarthy made.
The coup representative... representatives like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar back on committees. Gosar tweeted out a video depicting the murder of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Those are the people that the Republican Party stands with. So every time you hear how someone like Tucker Carlson or right-wing paleoconservatives are anti-war, the real anti-war representatives, figures in our government, are few and far between, and they're all just exclusively on the left. And Ilhan Omar is actually someone who challenges American empire and war efforts.
And this goes to show you also to what you asked earlier, Emma, that Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene were added to oversight. Gosar was removed from oversight initially because of the video he tweeted about fantasizing about killing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden. It goes to show you what accountability looks like in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There's no accountability for, I mean, yes, some people have gone to prison or been charged for their roles in January 6th, but none of the people who actually instigated it. It's the people who were told what to do, and it's the people who were brainwashed and indoctrinated into doing it for them, and the people in suits and the people who work on Capitol Hill who got off scot-free and have plum committee assignments now. The people who actually have consequences for their actions for things that they didn't even do, or things that they are being told or being said that they did and they didn't, are people like Ilhan Omar, because she tries to speak truth to power and tries to stand up to the bullshit that is fed to us about American foreign policy, and that's the person who gets punished.
Of course.
Not Paul Gosar, not Marjorie Taylor Greene, not Andy Biggs, not Kevin McCarthy, none of those guys. Not Mark Meadows, not Trump, obviously. Of course, he's under multiple investigations, but who's to say if he'll ever actually receive any semblance of accountability for anything that he's done? But all across the board, the people who suffer or the people who get punished at this level are the people who try and say something. And I don't give Matt Gaetz a lot of credit for anything, but one thing Matt Gaetz isn't is stupid. And he was on with, I don't remember, last week he was either on with Maria Bartiromo or somebody like that. And, oh no, it was on Newsmax. It was Newsmax with Jen Pellegrino. And he basically was like, I want Swalwell and Schiff off those committees, but I don't necessarily agree with the rationale for taking Ilhan Omar off. And I think it's not because of her anti-Semitic remarks or so-called anti-Semitic remarks. It's because she goes against America, goes against Republican and political orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And he even said, I would advise you, Jen Pellegrino, who of course probably doesn't even know who Elliot Abrams is, to watch her testimony. Because although Gaetz probably got his mind changed and voted for this, Gates knows why she's being taken off and what she provides.
Yeah.
And what the value is of her being on that committee and why they shouldn't have her on.
And it's just amazing. I mean, last thing on this, well said, Bradley. And also, the idea that they have any leg to stand on to remove her from the committee for anti-Semitism when Marjorie Taylor Greene put back on oversight was tweeting about Jewish space lasers. Like, I mean, give me a break here. Who's the representative that was called David Duke without the baggage too?
Only the second in command of House Republican
Scalise.
Leadership, Steve Scalise.
Great. Yeah. There you go. So, all right, with that said, we're going to wrap up the first hour of this program, head into the fun half, have some fun. But today we have ESPN. We're going to be talking about the Brady retirement, some NFL staffing stuff, shooting the shit, 4 p.m., youtube.com/ESPN show. Check us out. Yeah, we can bring Brandon in, but I will say that this show relies on your support. Become a member, join themajorityreport.com, help us out. We would love it. We got Brandon here.
Wait, they might not be able to hear me.
We can hear you.
Hey, Brandon.
There you are. Hey.
Hey, everybody. You just interrupted me singing Jumper by Third Eye Blind to myself.
It's a good one.
Why?
I love that song.
Oh, but no underlying concerns about.
Yeah.
Why would people
on ledges not jumping?
Oh, you know, I've never actually thought about the lyrics of the song.
You took it to a dark place.
Yeah, that's I get concerned here.
The movie Jumper is not about suicide; it's about teleporting. So, you know, I think there's plenty of precedent for.
Jumper was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid.
Really,
I saw that movie like 5 times in theaters.
That the one with Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
No, that's no. Looper.
Oh, sorry.
Jumper is Hayden Christensen.
Oh,
and
right.
Mila Kunis.
It's really
and Samuel Jackson.
It's apocalyptically stupid. Like it's one of the dumbest movies ever. But me and my friends were like, "We gotta go see Jumper."
So you can jump around in time.
Yeah, I saw it like so many times.
Have you seen Push?
What?
No, I should watch Push.
Push is like Jumper.
Yeah, I love all the time movies, the time jump movies.
Time travel movies. Gotcha. What's happening on the discourse, Brandon?
Well, I have promised the fans an episode about Avatar, and I will deliver that.
The fans promised I have.
The fans promised I have an episode about Avatar, yet I have not delivered. But we're going to do that this week, and we're also going to do a little talk about anime. You know, I've tapped one of my friends, Alex Patak, to join me to talk about Avatar 2 in the Bleach, Return of Bleach, the anime, not Bleach, the cleaning solution.
Gotcha.
To the airwaves. And so, yeah, I look forward to that. All my pop culture heads out there who love hearing me talk about things that no one cares about.
Well, check that out. I mean, some people seem to care. It's fun. It's fun. It's a good time.
About Avatar, at least, which is the third highest grossing movie to ever released.
Of course. Never doubt James Cameron. Also, really quick before we head into the fun half, because I guess we don't have Bender, but check out. Oh, we do. Let's let him in. Pre-order your Majority Report t-shirts. They're back on the shop. shop.majorityreportradio.com. Go there, don those. Saw somebody wearing one of those at the recent Give Them a Revolution live show, and hey, it's just completely padded my ego. So go get those. Binder, what's happening on Scam Economy and Doomed? Oh. Well, and you have no sound.
Oh, hold on, Binder. I don't know why that is. Wait.
Well, hello? Is that on your end, Binder? Talk? No.
How about now?
There you are.
Hey, Bender.
That was weird. Okay, but I'm here. Hello, everyone. On Doomed, I had on Rayvana, who you all might know from Twitch and DYT. And we discussed what's going on with dudes. From Andrew Tate's fans to the whole discourse that came out this week about AI deepfake porn. And apparently that even being something that you would argue about being fine, which it's obviously not.
Let's talk about that in the fun half. I have some really strong feelings about it.
Oh, I'm assuming pro it. No, I'm joking.
Yeah.
We're going to defend porn.
I'm going to play devil's advocate on this one. I feel like it's time. It's time for me to do my heel turn.
Right. Yeah.
This is why you leave the left, because of you're such a huge AI porn fan.
Right. So that's at youtube.com/Matt Binder. Also, this week's scam economy, I'll let you all know as soon as it's in the bag when that'll be up. And then later tonight on Leftist Mafia with, you know, David Dole, Mike Figueredo, Lance of the Serfs, the whole crew, we will have on, from what I understand, Nina Turner is going to join us for a little bit tonight. And that's at the Rational Nationals YouTube channel and at the Serfs Twitch channel.
Very cool. All right, we're going to head into the fun half then, and also just check out Left Reckoning for Matt in absentia. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black. Africans are back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.